Thank you for listening to this audio recording from LimoPlanet 2020 Free the Future. The following talk was presented at LimoPlanet, the Free Software Foundation's annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology. For more information on LimoPlanet, visit limoplanet.org/conference. LimoPlanet is a live conference with speakers who often use visual slides in their presentations. We have only selected talks for this audio feed that do not overly rely on visuals, but if you would like to see a speaker's slides, they are available at media.limoplanet.org. LimoPlanet speakers do not represent the Free Software Foundation. As part of our mission to show how important free software is to everyone, we have speakers talking about their use of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take positions on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedoms of all computer users, LimoPlanet is made possible by thousands of individuals who, like you, donate what they can. To keep this work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dee Dee Lavender, and I'm a senior software engineer at Spreedly, a fintech startup here in North Carolina. I'm also a director with Women Who Code in Raleigh-Durham. Encryption is a huge topic, and we're going to tackle a good chunk of it today. I'd like to acknowledge that we may represent a wide range of previous experience or understanding of this topic, and so we are going to cover some basics, including some vocabulary. In addition to explaining the different types of encryption and how they work, we will look at a few examples of how it impacts our lives and why it's important. I'm also hoping that we can talk a little bit about the future of encryption and what that might look like. So to start, how many of you have ever solved a CryptoQuote? There we go. So these are old-fashioned. I'm going to date myself a little bit now. My mom and sister and I used to solve these from the newspaper every day. My sister would copy it out for each of us, and we would race to solve it. She usually won. I think it could be because she had copied it out so many times that she absorbed the patterns. But let's start by defining what we mean by cryptography. Cryptography has very straightforward origins in the Greek language. Kryptos means hidden, and grapheme means to write. So some definitions that have evolved over time include secret writing or the art of writing or solving codes, and more specifically, a field that includes encryption and decryption. So then let's move ahead and define encryption. Okay. Encryption is the process of converting information or data into a code, and more importantly, includes the intention of preventing unauthorized access. This is the critical concept. Now, early encryption techniques were not as complicated as they are today. Around 1600 BC, the ancient Spartans used a device called a skytale. This was used to send secret messages during battle. It consisted of a leather strap wrapped around a wooden rod. When the leather strap was unwrapped, the letters were meaningless. they only made sense if the recipient had the correctly sized rod with the correct diameter. About 500 years later, Julius Caesar invented a substitution method of encryption that would shift the characters of the alphabet. If it were shifted by three places, then A would become D, B would become E, and so on. Perhaps some of you have heard of the Caesar cipher before. So let's define the word cipher. Now, this is one of those fun ones that can be a noun or a verb and has multiple definitions and usages. In its simplest sense, it is the method or the algorithm that performs the encryption or decryption. When using a cipher, the original information is known as plain text and the encrypted form as ciphertext. The ciphertext message contains all the information of the plain text message, but it is not in a format readable by a human or computer without the proper mechanism in place to decrypt it. That mechanism is what we refer to as a key. So using this giddily as an example, you could say the cipher was wrapping the leather strip around the rod. The key was the size or the diameter of the rod. And similarly for the Caesar cipher, we could say that the cipher was the shifting of the letters and the key was the direction and number of places that they were shifted. Now, encryption methods obviously became more sophisticated with time. The idea to use an agreed upon keyword for encrypting and decrypting emerged. The Playfair cipher was invented. It encrypts pairs of letters instead of single ones and is therefore harder to crack. There are lots of examples of really cool ciphers, actually, that could probably be a whole other talk. But take a look at this picture. Some of you may know it by sight, but it is the Enigma machine that was invented in 1918. Every time a key was pressed, three internal rotors took in that letter and then would output it as a different letter. The letter passed through all three rotors, bounced off a reflector at the end, and then passed back through all three rotors in the other direction. This was an amazing tool for encryption. Now, in 1945, Claude Shannon, a mathematician and electrical engineer, authored a paper called A Mathematical Theory of Cryptography. It was the precursor to another paper published a few years later called A Mathematical Theory of Communication that earned him the title the father of information theory. Now, at this point, cryptography and Shannon's work virtually disappear into secret government communication organizations such as the National Security Agency or NSA. Until the 1970s, of course, when things began to get interesting. By now, computers had been around for a bit and passwords were a thing. There were even a few personal computers out there. And so we should talk quickly about hashing. So encryption does not equal a hash. These terms are sometimes used interchangeably, but incorrectly so. A hash is not meant to be reversed. Encryption is meant to make data secure, which is to say we want encrypted data to be accessible or reversible, but only when authorized. So let's take a closer look. Now, hash is one of those words that can be used like a noun or a verb or an adjective. As an adjective, like in this diagram, hash describes an algorithm used to create a fixed length output representing the original data. So we might say this data was hashed. Or we might say, which hash are you using as a noun. Now, as a verb, hashing describes the transformation of the data into this representative string or number. So you might say, let me hash it first. As a noun, it represents the actual output of the hash function. Here's the hash we need. So in our diagram, we can see in the blue boxes that there are a varying amount of data in each set, and they go through a hash function. And let's assume that the yellow boxes all have the same hash function. And so they output a fixed length representation of the data that came through that hash algorithm. So there are a couple things about hashing that are really cool. One thing is that it's very fast to compute a hash value for any size or kind of data. And it should be impossible to regenerate the original message from its hash value. So it should be impossible to reverse the hash. Theoretically, there should be no hash collisions, or in other words, each message would have its own unique hash. And if an input is changed even slightly, just maybe flipping one bit, then the output would change significantly. So maybe half the output bits are flipped. Now, hashing originally came from a desire to compress data, but it was quickly recognized as a way to create unique identifiers and to ensure integrity. If something about the data has changed, even something very small, you would know because the hash value would also change. Okay. So let's talk about some of the hash algorithms that are out there. I'm sure the expression SHA is familiar to some of you, and this refers to a secure hash algorithm. Now, common hashing algorithms are publicly available tools, and secure hash algorithm has a whole family of algorithms out there. For instance, when you make a commit, Git is using an algorithm called SHA-1 to produce a hash of the contents of your commit, and then will allow you to reference that commit by the first 8 digits of the hash. Hashes are perfect for comparing values when you don't want to store raw data, like with emails, for example. You know how when you're shopping on the web, and then a few days later, that thing you were shopping for starts showing up in ads on other web pages that you're visiting? This is possible because they are matching a hash of your email. So whatever platform you were shopping on had access to your email address. They hash it using this algorithm, and then the ad machines are able to match up a hash of your email and then broadcast that advertisement back to you. Now, some hashing algorithms can be reverse engineered, and this will actually continue to be the case as technology becomes more sophisticated every moment. So MD5 is probably the most popular hashing algorithm, but it can easily be reversed even if you just type the hash value into Google. So SHA-256 or above is recommended for situations where security is vital, and it produces a 32-byte hash value. So since I mentioned bytes, let's be sure we're also clear about this. Encryption does not equal encoding. These terms are sometimes mistakenly used interchangeably. While they both transform data into another format, encoding uses publicly available schemes that are intended to be reversed. Decoding only requires knowing which scheme was used to encode. You can think of it more like a map or a legend or even a table. Encryption, on the other hand, is meant to protect valuable or sensitive information, and decryption is designed to be much more complicated. Your data is transformed using an algorithm or a series of algorithms plus a secret key, and the intention is that encrypted data not be easily reversed. Again, a difference between encryption and encoding. So if we say the purpose of encoding is to transform data so that it can be properly and safely consumed by a different type of system, then we can look at some everyday examples to understand this. Now, Morse code, for example, uses dots and dashes of sound or light, along with varying length pauses to communicate certain characters over long distances. Another example of encoding that we are all familiar with is Braille, where physical raised bumps represent letters and symbols. The goal is not to keep information secret, but rather to ensure that it's able to be properly consumed. So in the world of computers, encoding refers to how information or data is stored on the computer and how computers and people talk to each other. Now, we know computers use binary code comprised of the digits 1 and 0 to store data. And to communicate with computers, we have to understand the basics of binary code. That smallest unit of data is called a bit, a 1 or a 0. Groups of 8 bits are called bytes. So here is an example of 4 bytes. This numerical system maps to all other number systems, which is amazing. The way you get from binary to our familiar decimal or base 10 number system is super fun and involves powers of 2. Let's take a quick look at how the number systems line up. So if you didn't get the binary joke earlier, now's your chance to figure it out. Using this number system translation, encoding schemes allow us to communicate or share data with computers. It translates those bits or ones and zeros into language that we understand and can process. It's basically a set of mappings between the bytes in the computer and the character set of a language. Now, one of the first encoding standards to become popular in computing is the American Standard Code for Information Exchange, commonly known as ASCII. So first published in 1963, ASCII uses 7 bits to encode 128 specified characters. And if you remember your powers of 2, you'll remember that 2 to the 7th equals 128. So cool. Now, 95 of the encoded characters are printable. These include the digits 0 to 9, uppercase and lowercase letters A to Z, and punctuation symbols. The original ASCII specification also included 33 non-printing control codes, and those are mostly now obsolete. But obviously, 95 characters is not sufficient, and ASCII has been superseded by UTF-8. There could be a whole nother talk in here about that. But let's take a look at an example of UTF-8 encoding. So each byte represents 1 letter or character. Remember when we said a SHA-256 hashing algorithm produced a 32-byte hash value? So each byte has 8 bits, and 32 to the 8th equals 256, or 32 times 8 equals 256. Okay, so now that we have encoding and hashing covered, let's go back to the 1970s. In the 70s, there were 2 major public advances in encryption. The first publicly sanctioned block cipher, known as the DES, or Data Encryption Standard, came out. Now, a block cipher is a method of encrypting text, again, to produce ciphertext, in which a cryptographic key and algorithm are applied to a block of data, for example, 64 contiguous bits, at once as a group rather than to 1 bit at a time. Now, this is a big leap from the 1920s and the Enigma machine. The math and exact process of this cipher is really super cool, but we are going to keep it high level. The second major development came in the form of a paper that would prove over time to fundamentally change the way crypto systems work. It was authored by Whitfield Diffie and Martin Hellman. I love the spirit of this first paragraph, and I'm going to read it to you because it's a bit small. We stand today on the brink of a revolution in cryptography. The development of cheap digital hardware has freed it from the design limitations of mechanical computing and brought the cost of high-grade cryptographic devices down to where they can be used in such commercial applications as remote cash dispensers and computer terminals. In turn, such applications create a need for new types of cryptographic systems, which minimize the necessity of secure key distribution channels and supply the equivalent of a written signature. At the same time, theoretical developments in information theory and computer science show promise of providing provably secure crypto systems, changing this ancient art into a science. Essentially, they developed a method for two parties that have no prior knowledge of each other to jointly establish a shared secret key over an insecure channel. It's called the Diffie-Hellman or DH key exchange. Now, traditionally, secure encrypted communication between two parties required that they first exchange keys by some secure physical channel. Imagine the limitations of paper key lists transported by a trusted courier. So this was a phenomenal development. I love this visual of how the DH key exchange actually works. You agree on a common color to start with, and only you know your secret color, which you mix with the starting color. You then share the mixed color with each other, re-add your secret color, and now you have the same common secret color. Someone might know your starting color if you communicated that over an insecure channel, but it would be nearly impossible to figure out the common secret color without knowing each secret color. Okay, I'm saying colors, but you know this is really about math. Everything is about math. Okay, so far, when we have mentioned keys, we have talked in the singular. One key. Both the DES and the DH key exchange are based on a singular key. And there are two types of encryption in widespread use today, symmetric and asymmetric encryption. And the name is derived from whether or not the same key is used for encryption and decryption. In symmetric encryption, the same key is used for encryption and decryption. We can see why it is therefore critical that a secure method exists to transport or share the key between the sender and the recipient. This is why Diffie and Hellman's key distribution scheme was so critical. It laid the groundwork for the development of asymmetric encryption. So where symmetric encryption uses one shared key, asymmetric encryption uses a key pair, a public key and a private key. It is also known as public key encryption. The public key may be disseminated widely, but the private key should be known only to the owner. Effective security simply requires keeping the private key private, and the public key can be openly distributed without compromising security at all. The public and private keys in a key pair are inseparable, and of course, each pair is unique. The public key belongs to its corresponding private key and only that corresponding private key. Now, the public key is used to encrypt. Anyone can do that. And the private key is used to decrypt. And that's, of course, the more sensitive operation. So, keep your private keys safe. Now, one critical application of asymmetric encryption in our modern world is digital signatures. So a digital signature is sometimes referred to as an electronic fingerprint. It accomplishes two main objectives in providing a layer of validation and security to messages. It verifies the sender, and it ensures the data is untampered with. In addition to authenticating the source and the integrity of the data, it offers non-repudiation when necessary. So let's take a look at this diagram. Find the two boxes that say data. And you can see that in the first instance, the data goes through a hashing function and a hash is produced. And then the signer's private key and the hash are used they go through a signature algorithm and are sent to the verifier along with the data. So then the verifier decrypts the data using the hashing function and goes through the signing algorithm to verify it using their public key, and their hashes should be equal. And in that way, we know that the sender is verified and the data is untampered with. Okay, now one of the most well-known signature algorithms is RSA. Now, RSA stands for the initials of the three friends who worked out this solution: Ron Rivest, Adi Shamir, and Leonard Alderman. They were all at MIT trying to pick up where Diffie and Hellman had left off. Now, Diffie and Hellman introduced the idea of asymmetric public-private key pairs, but they didn't formulate the necessary one-way function to actually produce the key pair. In mathematical terms, this one-way function, known as a trapdoor function, and it's easy to compute, but hard to reverse or inverse. So a simple example is, if I told you that 6,895,601 is the product of two prime numbers, what are those numbers? That would be incredibly hard to figure out. But conversely, if I gave you two prime numbers and asked you what their product is, you could easily figure that out. So this is an example of a trapdoor function. So what RSA does is it generates two very large co-prime numbers that each have 1,024 bits each. Now, co-prime means that the only thing both numbers have in common is that the only number they are divisible by is one. Then they are further put through a series of mathematical operations to generate the private and public keys. Remember, the public key is used to encrypt and the private key is used to decrypt. So RSA is widely used in digital signatures and is only one of many signature algorithms currently in use. So this is all talking about asymmetric encryption, again, using public and private key pairs. And it plays a very big role in what we know as public key infrastructure. Now, this is actually a very simplified diagram of public key infrastructure, but I wanted to show you this. And what I'm hoping you'll see is the application of some of the technology we've discussed so far, namely the use of public and private key pairs and digital signatures to achieve an underlying security service. So the purpose of public key infrastructure is to manage those keys and certificates. By managing keys and certificates through a PKI, or public key infrastructure, an organization is able to establish and maintain a trustworthy networking environment. A PKI enables the use of encryption and digital signature services across a wide variety of applications. Here are some modern day applications of public key encryption. And you'll also hear it referred to as asymmetric encryption. Those terms are interchangeable. You can infer from either name that a private key is needed to decrypt. Secure email, desktop security, web-based security, e-commerce, access control, virtual private networks, digital signatures. These are all examples of public key encryption at work. Now, hang on. We're going to back up a bit. We were talking about the DH key exchange, and how it laid the groundwork for the innovation of asymmetric encryption, which is used in so many areas of our life. But I want to circle back to symmetric encryption and how it's used. So we talked briefly about DES, the first publicly sanctioned block cipher that came out in the 70s. Does anyone remember what that stands for? It's Data Encryption Standard. Now, it uses a relatively small key, only 56 bits, and it has been broken in cryptography terms. Now, that means something very specific in the world of encryption. It means that it can be solved faster. It can be solved in faster than brute force time. So brute force basically means guessing. Even if you're using a systematic approach, it's still sort of guessing. So improvements have been made over time, and you may have heard about 3DES or triple DES. Triple DES uses a key bundle that comprises 3 DES keys, each of 56 bits. That is also technically broken, which doesn't mean that it isn't still in use. It definitely is. It just means that it's used in less than ultra secure applications. That's why I picked this image. So DES and triple DES are like eyeglasses that are broken, but you're still using them. So in 1997, about 21 years ago, in response to the attacks on triple DES, the National Institute of Standards Institution put out a call for submissions for an advanced encryption standard. We think of the advanced encryption standard as AES, and this call for submissions was a really big deal. So the some of the requirements were that the algorithms all needed to be block ciphers, which again means encrypting chunks at a time, and it needed to be able to support a block size of 128 bits. And it needed key sizes of 128, 192, and 256 bits. So the process overall took about 5 years, and there were amazing finalists. The official choice was declared in 2001 and actually remains the standard today. So the winner of this competition is called the Rheindahl algorithm, and it is now the Advanced Encryption Standard, or AES. So this algorithm was designed by two Belgian cryptologists, Vincent Riemann and Joan Damon, and their surnames are reflected in the cipher's name. The Rheindahl is a substitution linear transformation cipher. I know those are a lot of words, but it uses triple discrete invertible uniform transformation layers. Is this sounding exciting or what? Overall, the structure of Rheindahl displays a very high degree of modular design, and that will make modification to counterattacks developed in the future much simpler than with past algorithm designs. Although this underpins the AES, or Advanced Encryption Standard, and is approved in the United States for high-level government documents, there are many, many other symmetric algorithms that are in use in addition to the Rheindahl. So here is an example of some other places where we might see symmetric encryption. And again, remember, symmetric encryption means that the same key is used to both encrypt and decrypt. So payment applications, secure file transfer protocols, files and file systems, and archiving and compression tools. So one advantage that symmetric encryption has over asymmetric encryption is speed. Asymmetric encryption has these added layers of security with the public and private keys, but the trade-off is processing speed. So modern-day encryption protocols often combine the two different types of encryption. One example of this is TLS, or transport layer security. Now, TLS supersedes SSL, or secure socket layer protocols. This is a cryptographic protocol that provides end-to-end communication security over networks and is widely used for internet communications and online transactions. The IETF, or Internet Engineering Task Force, has set it as a standard intended to prevent eavesdropping, tampering, and message forgery. So common applications that employ TLS include web browsers, instant messaging, email, and voice over IP. Some of you may be impacted by recent upgrades or upgrade requirements to TLS 1.3 or 1.2. Now, when we talk about encrypting data, there is often a distinction, between data in motion versus data at rest. Now, encryption plays a major role in data protection in general and is a critical tool for securing data both in transit and at rest. For protecting data in transit, enterprises often choose to encrypt sensitive data prior to moving and or use encrypted connections, HTTPS, SSL, TLS, et cetera, to protect the contents of the data in transit. For protecting data at rest, enterprises can simply encrypt sensitive files prior to storing them and or choose to encrypt the storage drive itself. Okay, well, that was a lot. And let's take a deep breath and think about the future of encryption. Now, I'm sure you've heard of quantum computing or quantum cryptography. It is completely mind-bending and awesome. Eventually, quantum computers will render some of our strongest encryption tactics useless, cracking asymmetric encryption in seconds, thanks to their ability to work quickly, to work out those long prime numbers quickly that were used to generate the public and private key pairs. So since we know that that's coming, there's time to adapt, right? I am not panicking yet. Without getting too deep into quantum physics, quantum key distribution, which is the most well-known example of quantum cryptography, it all hinges on the fact that measuring the state of a photon actually changes its state. So that is super, super cool. And although advances are coming in all the time, the most powerful quantum computers in existence right now can only handle about 72 qubits, which are quantum bits, meaning that they can only deal with strings 72 bits long, which is far shorter than most cryptographic keys. All that to say, if you want to get in on creating quantum cryptography solutions, you still have time. Maybe less time than we hope, but you still have time. Eventually, using quantum technology, it may even be possible to build entire encryption systems that are considered unbreakable. Okay, thank you so much for listening to these thoughts about the basics of encryption. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We've got about 5 minutes for questions. I'm looking at the chat room now. A quick question. Is there a way to create a kind of one-way or trapdoor function, you think, that can sort of deal with quantum computers?
So they, that has not been done yet, to my knowledge, but there are people who are devoting their entire lives and careers to this question, so I would expect that to happen at some point, but not yet.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you so much for your talk.
Thank you.